Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking about Oscar Blumner, the artist, and we'll be talking about the play The Guys. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Armand Saia. He is the director of Desert Grows, and he is the main farmer at Infinity Farms. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello there. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you. Now, we had you on, I guess, in the spring, mm-hmm. and you were ready. You were talking about what Desert Grows was, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I just wanted to get a farmer on to talk about what this season was like. Let's start for a moment with Desert Grows. What is that nonprofit organization? It's desertgrows.org.
Well, Desert Grows raises money, and then it buys from local farms to help them reach sustainability. And then it takes that the food that they buy from those farms and distributes it in the food banks, along with educational programs to teach people how to eat these foods so that we can broaden their diets, the spectrum of their diets, and with fabulous success, I might add, and very little money at this point. We almost landed a $216,000 grant. We got this close, and I think we got beat out by the Farmers Market Association because they had been in existence longer, and well, this is what I was told on the telephone.
Yeah, right.
And this, that, and the other thing. You didn't do this, you didn't do that, and you should have said more about this. And
well, now you know for next time.
Shoulda, woulda, coulda, yes. But also, it was because our fabulous Congress cut all the money to the state radically.
Ah.
Otherwise, we would have been funded. We were in the final. We were in the package.
That Congress set of people in Washington, D.C.
Well, then they cut the money, right, and they only sent New Mexico one quarter of the money they were allocated.
Ah. So you were buying food from farmers to help them reach sustainability. Tell us about that piece.
Well, in my estimation, the farmers are doing really well and they have a lot of stuff, but for example, Sheila Berry at Dragonfly Farms right now has piles of cucumbers. Now, if I was able to buy all those cucumbers from her, she wouldn't have to be stressing about where to unload them. And then I could just be handing out all these cucumbers at the food banks.
Right.
So I could go, especially in Caruco in Rivera. It's a little small satellite part of the town. It's like a borough.
Right.
We have 13 boroughs.
What are you, from New York?
Yes. and then the other one is in Bernal, just a little ways down the highway. And we have four other food banks waiting for our fresh produce, but we can't get funded yet. So we're struggling to bring in the funds to do this. And it's a full-time job for me to keep working with. I mean, I've worked with wonderful people like Carol from Slow Foods, for example, to help me raise money through the slow food movement. And people have been quite generous, but it's a full-time job.
Right.
And if I'm doing that, I'm not farming. I need to be able to, direct this activity and be the front man and be out driving this thing, and then I need people to work there. So that's what the grants were for, so that we could set up, a better, way of doing it.
So the example you brought up just a moment ago raises an interesting question. So one farm, Dragonfly Farm, has an excess of cucumbers. Mm-hmm. Part of what any farmer has to do is really know their market if they're a small farmer and know right. how many of this or that type of thing are going to be bought.
Right. Well, in organic farming, There are many ways of doing this, but we don't use pesticides, one thing that everybody knows. But the way we do that is we alternate rows of food. So, you allocate a row to, say, cucumbers. Then you have string beans. Then you have broccoli. And it goes on and on, so that the bugs get mixed up from row to row to row.
What do you mean they get mixed up?
Well, they don't know, you know, it's not like a monocrop.
Right.
It's not like a big area that they can move in.
So there are bugs that only like broccoli.
Exactly.
So the broccoli bugs have to know to go to like 47th Street, basically.
Exactly. Right. So they, you know, if you're using these different crops and then you're planting things they don't like in between, it repels the bugs.
And that works.
Sort of. And then you have to do other things, you know.
What are the other things you do?
Oh, you might put diatomaceous earth on, you know, on the crops. That works. Wood ash works. You can use neem if you can find it. And I don't like to do it. It's a last resort because it is a chemical made out of natural stuff, just like everything.
Neem from the neem tree in India?
Yeah. So that works. And then there's... then there's pyrethrum, which is also used, and that is that's even stronger and even more of a chemical. I think that's made out of geranium, but you can put mint in between. You can put marigolds in there. You can do all kinds of things if you have the time to do it. Quite frankly, staying in front of the weeds is insane, and everything I do, I'd like to make a distinction here too. There's organic farming and there's organic farming. There's organic farming that's transported by fuel, diesel fuel, fossil fuels, long distances, and there's tractor farming, which I don't like tractors because tractors use fuel. So I work really hard at trying to do everything by hand. So once we break the soil and we turn it and we work in the manures, we make permanent beds. And those beds are maintained and fed.
Now, you are out there every day manually pulling all the weeds as well as everything else.
Every day we pull the weeds. And when there was no rain for 8 months, it was insane. Now, fortunately, I got a grant to do some redundancy on my watering abilities. So I have open catchments that I was able to put in. I have 7 patches of drip irrigated areas that are fed from a well, and that was fine when the well was working. I would have been out of business already if they didn't work. They did work, and I was able to water until the well went dry. And then I was
And the well went dry this summer?
The well went dry this summer. Then I was on the catchment, and I used up everything from the catchment. I mean, during this whole thing, I'm also on the board of the Acequia, and I'm the secretary. And the acting.
Of the yeah, Association.
And I do the work of the Mayor Duomo, the physical work. I don't have the title.
Right.
So I am going nuts. And we had to fix the dam this year, and we had money that had to be spent. Because once it's allocated, it has to be spent in a certain amount of time. So we had to do the repairs on the dam. That meant in the middle of the drought, we had to shut down the Acequia for... I don't remember exactly. I think it ended up being almost 8 weeks, which was nerve-wracking.
That's crazy.
Well, I was right down to the last drops of water by the end, and then the Acequia came on. Fortunately, there was enough water from the snow melt at that time. And then I've seen the Pecos River almost dry. The only water flowing in the Pecos River went through the Acequias. And then came out the other end and continued down to the next Acequia until it was dried up. And just 15 miles south down the river, bone dry, nothing. So there are a lot of people this year that didn't get to grow crops. On top of that, we had a late freeze, froze all the fruit buds, no fruit. And it was abysmal. I mean, we were watering twice a day, and the crops... Just stayed there. They didn't grow. They just stayed at whatever
at
size
what?
They
Six
were.
6 inches, 12 inches tall.
Yeah. Where they were stuck in the ground. And they just stayed that way for the longest time. I mean, tomatoes are almost 45 days late.
45 days late.
And mine started extra early this year because I had many volunteers. Because I tried a new thing. Of taking all my old tomatoes putting them in the compost but not composting them all together, and then mixing it together, and then I put them all out. And then I had volunteer tomatoes everywhere.
Ah.
So in February, at the end of February, tomatoes started coming up. So these were really strong, super strong tomatoes. These are really ones that wanted to grow, your volunteers. So I let them go. And I let them go everywhere, and then I'd weed out the ones that were in the wrong spaces and stuff until it got a little more uniform.
Just so people know, volunteers means not that you got a bunch of school children to help you grow them, but that the seeds just came up all by themselves.
In this case, yes. In this case, that's the kind of volunteers. And I use a lot of volunteers.
You use people volunteers, right, too.
Yeah, so that's a great distinction. Yeah. But those plants just stayed. They grew to a certain size and just sat there. And then we would water and water and water. It got so discouraging. Speaking of volunteers, I had 4 volunteers at one time on the farm. One from Chicago, a couple from Los Angeles, and a kid from Wellesley, Mass. And they were all there together, and it was at the peak of everything. It was over 100 degrees every day. We're out there carrying water, weeding, and stuff like that. It just drove them insane to the point where they abandoned me. They just couldn't take it anymore. They went to Santa Fe, hung out in a big mansion. They met somebody at the farmer's market, and they all jumped ship and went and stayed there and swam in the swimming pool.
So you were stuck.
And I was stuck there by myself.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was the stress from the, constant watering and trying to do the Desert Grows projects and everything. We were butchering chickens at the time, and I lost it. Quite frankly, I lost it, and that didn't add, it didn't help matters at all.
We're talking to Armand Saia, the farmer of Infinity Farms and the director of DesertGrows.org. So you grow, is this what's, we read in, like, Michael Pollan about these closed-loop farms where you've got chickens and then the manure is turned into fertilizer and that fertilizes your tomatoes and then the compost and some of the food is fed to the animals. And so do you have one of those kinds of
situations?
That's
exactly what's going on here. Everything is connected, and there's interconnectivity between everything, and there is no waste. So all of those manures are used. The chickens were fantastic in the fact that I got all that straw and all that chicken manure, and that went into my compost piles and fueled it with great heat and helped burn it up and make beautiful soil. So now I have piles of wonderful soil. I have 4 kinds of manure that I've been using this year. In fact, Desert Grows has been giving away manure and delivering it, paying for it to be delivered to farms in the valley also. And we did that as long as we could. And as soon as we raise more money or get granted, we'll be able to continue that process.
Now,
but I mean, that's how we build our soil.
Do you also sell your crops at farmers market and so on?
Yes. I do 4 farmers markets. I do El Dorado. I helped with the Pecos Farmers Market. I'm not currently doing that because we're building the El Valle Farmers Market, and they both are on Sundays. But the El Valle Farmers Market is a beautiful little market and worth driving out to and helping to support. So you could drive out to Rivera and get off at the Villanueva stop, and then go and eat at Larissa Cafe, and then right across the street is the farmer's market. So you'd be able to really come and indulge in some of our fantastic tomatoes and cucumbers and squash. And
now, have you figured out that formula of how to grow food so that everything you have sells?
I have no waste, absolutely no waste, and I can't even grow enough for the markets right now. Now, I do have to say that the markets have been very, very, I don't even know the word for it. It just seems like sales are down at least 50%.
People aren't going to farmers markets anymore?
Well, they're going to the farmers markets. They're not spending money, especially El Dorado. I think everybody's on fixed incomes, and they keep looking at their statements, and they're totally freaked out. And I think that's an economic factor that is happening, and all the farmers are feeling it.
Now, you've been doing educational programs with DesertGrows.org also.
Yeah, correct. Every Sunday I've been bringing vegetables to the Karuko Church, and they have a lovely kitchen. And after their service, they come out, and I've been serving vegetables there and then teaching people how to cook them. Many sautéed vegetables and lots of salad. I even now, you know, the line goes through, the children go through first. The kids eat all the salad, and by the time, the adults get there, there's no salad left.
Really?
But when
I started, I didn't know kids liked salad.
Yeah, when I started, the kids didn't eat any salad at all. So they taste the difference, they can see what's happening, and I'm over there constantly driving them and, you know, trying to capture their interest in tasting it.
They're also learning how to grow chickens.
Those were adults.
Oh, those were adults.
Those were all adults. And that program was set up to teach people how to grow organic chickens and then how to butcher those chickens and then dress them and clean them and then how to save the organs and use the whole chicken.
What do you do with the organs?
Oh, well, the livers are delicious. The gizzards are fantastic. The hearts are good.
Do you use them in, like, a stuffing, like a turkey?
No. You can sauté the livers, and I caramelize them with sugar so that by the end, when they're finished, there's butter and sugar all over them. They're absolutely fantastic. Trick is not to cook them too long.
Right. Now, you are farming four seasons out of the year.
That is a big emphasis of both Infinity Farm and Desert Grows, to be able to supply food in four seasons. And why? Because farmers markets that only exist during the summer, it's a no-brainer. People are, people are used to that, and that's what happens. But then it stops, and then you have to build it up every single year. I believe we should just go all year long and be able to sustain ourselves. And I believe building the food chain across the United States in a local fashion is sustainable. And I think this stuff can be grown. If we eat seasonally, we can have all the food that we need without touching any of these farms. And hence, raise war against all these big industrial farmers and these big industrial mentality out there growing to, and delivering foods out of season and shipping and all this. I think that a local food is the way of the future.
Now, you lived in Manhattan for 20 years. You come out here, suddenly you're a farmer, which is amazing to me. I've actually been kind of playing with the calculations about the amount of water we have, the amount of land, and so on, and whether New Mexico could really truly feed itself without shipping stuff from out of state. Maybe we'd still have to ship stuff around a little bit within the state. I mean, obviously, you've got to put you don't walk to farmers market, you put things in a truck, presumably. But this question of, for really big cities, how do you see feeding 10 million people with the kind of farms that you have, that you're talking about?
I don't know the exact math, but I know that we can feed thousands. I know that I can feed, if I can produce 100 pounds of lettuce, 800 salads, okay, out of every 100 pounds. So if I'm growing 400 pounds, that's a lot. That's one farm, okay? And I think that the idea is many small farms, which creates lifestyle and rural development. I mean, how do you develop? You're always hearing rural development, economic development, blah, 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 and then they put all this money in the stuff, and what do you ever see? Okay. But if you're bringing families out to farms and offering them a way of life, small farm, yeah, you got to work hard. Okay. But it's a wonderful way of life, and it builds community.
And when the rest of the system goes down, you're eating.
Exactly. So I know that Ribera can feed itself. So my goal is just to feed my area there. So if I can help build community and help strengthen our ties between each farm and each farmer, then we have some sort of unity that makes you feel like you're not standing alone against the wind, like we did all spring. And I know we can feed ourselves this way. And, you know, 10 million people, well, think of the opportunities around New York City. You know you're going to grow X amount. The farmers in the Hudson Valley can't even grow enough to meet demands.
To meet the needs of the farmers market.
So we need more farmers, more land. And if we had a government that supported this concept, I mean, it's a no-brainer. We could go back to 60 years ago, 70 years ago, before the Industrial Revolution in farming, and we would be we would be sustaining ourselves.
And perhaps eating considerably healthier food.
Absolutely eating better food.
Arman Saeed is the director of Desert Grows, which can be found at desertgrows.org, and he's the farmer at Infinity Farms. Thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Yeah.
We're going to take a little break now. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome to the program Victoria Addison. She's the owner of Addison Row Fine Art on Marcy Street here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me here.
So you have a show in the gallery right now until the 12th of September called Oscar Blumner, Little Gems. Now, who was the artist Oscar Blumner?
Oscar Blumner was a very interesting artist, and to me, represents the very tenets of color and brightness and energy and life in art. He came to this country from Germany in 1892. He was an architect by trade, and he lived mostly between Chicago and New York doing his architecture. In 1910, he met Alfred Stieglitz. Well, we know what an amazing man Stieglitz was.
The husband of Georgia O'Keeffe and the patron of so many artists whose work he showed in his galleries.
Right. And this association opened up a whole world for him. He became one of Stieglitz's group, so to speak. He had his first one-man show at the 291 Gallery in 1915. And he was associated with a lot of very important artists we know, Georgia O'Keeffe, Marston Hartley, John Maron, the whole group. And before his shows, and actually around the time he met Stieglitz, he had given up architecture and really become an artist. And he called himself a pure colorist. In fact, he called himself the Vermilionaire.
Because he liked the color vermilion.
He loved it. He loved red. Red was everything to him. He told Stieglitz that he invented red. But it's mostly what he would do is paint everything you and I are used to seeing. Cityscapes, landscapes, the trees, the sky, everything around us that we recognize. But he painted it in color. And so the trees could be black with yellow and purple leaves.
So unrealistic color, yeah.
Totally unrealistic. In fact, he was creating. He didn't want to be a copyist. He didn't want to be like the classically trained artist who did portraits. He wanted to create. He wanted to be absolutely unique. And he would actually paint almost unworldly-like subjects. But when you look at them, they don't seem that way. They just evoke emotion, and you think that you've seen this before. But he had a whole theory that certain colors juxtaposed to each other would create moods. And so he would do drawing after drawing after drawing, and he'd write little notes to himself as to what colors should be next to each other, and that would create the mood. So he was very methodical about his art, but he was also just thinking of it as a composition, as music, as evoking moods and excitement. So
he lived a life in which he didn't achieve major success, and then he took his own life.
Yeah, that's the other thing that's amazing, because to look at his art, you wouldn't think he was a very sad man.
Yeah, right.
But he was very sad. He struggled a lot with his art. He struggled with being successful. He struggled with money issues. And you wouldn't see that when you look at his work, because a lot of his moonscapes or sunscapes, the circular energy around that vision is bright and colorful and all about life. But truly, he was very sad. And he was very connected to his wife. His wife died many years before him, and that sort of sent him into a little decline. And then in 1935, he was hit by a car, which really affected his health, and he started to go into a decline and then was told he couldn't paint. So beyond that, his life really became very unhappy, and he was very disillusioned. So he actually commits suicide, and he planned it very carefully. He put a white cloth on his bed and a white cloth over him, and he slit his wrists and his neck.
Oh, Lord.
So going by the Vermillionaire, there's... Oh, God. Yeah, you know, so he was a pretty dramatic guy, all in all.
So then after his death, I mean, here you are in an art gallery showing his work. I mean, what happened? Was he suddenly elevated to the great artist that he was later thought of as being, or did he just slide into obscurity for a while?
Well, it's been sort of an up and down process for him. There have been lots of shows of his work. There have been lots of museum exhibitions, a lot of books, a lot of articles written about him. His estate really started being promoted in the 70s. That's when I first started in the art business, and I knew about his work back then. And I think most recently there was a huge retrospective at the Whitney Museum, and that's been in the last 5 years. So he's never reached the zenith that some artists do, but he also has had quite a bit of recognition since his death.
So where does he stand? I mean, if somebody has a show at the Whitney Museum in New York, then that kind of elevates them. But where does he stand among the artists of the Stieglitz Circle when there's a collection, when somebody, a museum or an individual, is collecting art of that time? Do they always have a Blumner or more than one Oscar Blumner painting?
Well, they should, yes. They should consider that. In fact, there's a book right now called Pioneers, and that's all about Stieglitz's group and the artists from that period, and he's in there.
Right.
He's in every reference. He's in every book. His format was small. The reason I titled my show Little Gems is he really didn't paint large paintings, a few. And most of those, of course, are in private collections. And they're not easy to get to see,
right,
unless there's a big museum exhibition.
In which case they borrow from those private collectors for
exactly.
a few months.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you, when you're putting together, you know, albeit a small exhibition in a gallery, but an exhibition of this artist's work or any artist's work, how do you find out, A, who has these pieces, and B, who's willing to part with them? In other words, to give them to a gallery with the potential of selling them.
It's a long process. A lot of it started really because a gentleman came to me who has a whole collection of drawings by Oscar Blumner, and he wanted me to have an exhibition at the gallery. And I thought, well, I have always loved Blumner's work. I've always been a fan of his work. Wouldn't that be wonderful to be able to do that? But I knew I didn't just want to do drawings, that there's much more to Blumner's work and to an exhibition, and especially him being a colorist, you want to be able to represent works that represent what he was capable of painting. So I started this process of, well, this would be very exciting. Where do I go, like you asked? And I've been in the business a very long time. I have a lot of colleagues all around the country, and I have followed the market through auctions and private sales for a lot of years. If you go to galleries, you'll see things on their walls. If you go to auctions, things come up for sale. So I started putting the word out, basically, that I was going to be doing a Blumner show. And this took me a little over a year to finally get from first thinking about doing it to putting it on the wall. And I took several trips back east, and I talked to different colleagues, and I asked people if they knew of anything in private hands, then if people wanted to. So bit by bit, that's how it developed, really. I got a lot of support in the art community, a lot of people willing to help me.
Now, on the other side, do you find that people are really interested in adding work by this artist to their collections?
I've been really actually very excited because a lot of people haven't known who Oscar Blumner was, mostly people who are not big-time collectors but interested in art. And when the article came out in the journal and when I sent out announcements to a lot of my mailing list, people went online and they said, who is this guy? This is fabulous. This is beautiful. Who is he? And I had friends call me and say, this is so great. We didn't know anything about him. And we went online and we learned. And then I'd have people come in with the article or the mailer or word of mouth, people saying you need to come and see the show. So that was very good, I thought. It was good to get people who didn't know who he was to come in and see, and then to spread it out to the community of people who are interested in his work and know him. In fact, I actually had the curator from the Stetson Museum come in and see the show specifically because she was going to be here. Now, the Stetson Museum inherited a major body of work from Oscar Blumner's daughter.
Uh-huh.
And so they're very versed in keeping his name out there and promoting him. In fact, there's an exhibition they're going to have in the fall. And she wanted to come in and see the show, and she was just thrilled to see what we had.
How do you determine the value of a work of art, of a painting, of a drawing, whether it be by Blumner or somebody else? And what are the factors? I mean, the same painting might have cost $47 when he was alive.
Exactly.
That costs $150,000 now or something like that.
But
in the current day, what are the factors that push the value of an artist's work up or down?
It's very complicated. It is not an easy process. I do this a lot because I'm also an appraiser. And you have to follow markets. You have to follow trends. You have to know what has sold privately through other dealers. You have to know what's been selling at auction. You have to understand the quality, the medium, the size variation, the dates in which the pieces were painted, because some artists had a period that they were more well known for than others. Some works, like for Blumner, things from the teens are considered very valuable. But they're stylistically different than things that are later. And so you have to follow really the markets and the trends and the artists and the pieces.
So for example, if Blumner has a show at the Whitney Museum, does the value of his work double overnight?
It doesn't double overnight, but it gives solidity to the market. It definitely gives solidity to the value of the artist and the importance of the artist.
Meaning solidity means it's not as likely to go down?
It's not going to disappear, one would hope.
What about the stock market? When the stock market dives by 7 zillion points or whatever, does the value of art also go down?
No, it doesn't dive like that. I've seen the markets go up and down. I've seen trends go up and down. I've seen, like in the late 80s, when a lot of the market was being driven by money from Japan and people were pushing the market. There are artificial means that push pricing. But it doesn't go up one day and down one day, not like the stock market. It doesn't crash quite like that. But it's a very interesting, exciting business because also you can have a painting sell at auction that's estimated for maybe $2 or $3 million, and you have two people who are just dying to have this painting, and suddenly it sells for $14 or $18 million. Well, that does push the rest of that art's value up a little bit.
Right.
But
that's the craziness of auctions.
Oh,
I've seen rug auctions where two people got into a bidding war over something that wasn't even very good.
Oh, I know. It's amazing. I just love going to auction for that reason. And I love standing on the sidelines and just watching what's being done. Because it's, I don't want to say it's a game. It's not a game, because this is serious money and this is serious art and people love it. But it's a fascinating development that we've had where the auctions are taking over so much of the trend of the market.
The show is called Oscar Blumner Little Gems, and it's at the Addison Rowe Fine Art Gallery on Marcy Street here in Santa Fe. Victoria Addison, thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. It's been a great pleasure and a lot of fun.
Oh, I forgot to say. And the show will be up until September 12th.
That's correct, right.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Mona Malik. She is the director of the play The Guys that opens tonight at Warehouse 21. And Karen Lee and Scott Harrison, who are the two actors, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So this is a 9/11 play that was written right after 9/11. Tell us about it.
Karen actually brought the play to me. It was written, the play was written 3 months after the event.
It was performed 3 months
It was performed after 3 months after. Yeah. So it was written even sooner. Wow.
And it's a play about a writer who meets up with a fireman who has lost a lot of people in his, what would you call it?
His company.
Thank you. Has to speak at their funerals and doesn't know how to write a eulogy. And the writer does know. And so it's about their collaboration, which is a beautiful thing and makes one feel like this could be about anybody we know.
Exactly. I mean, I really looked at this play as 9/11 is a character or a background, but the play is really about the individual experience of connection and grief and help and the way we reach out to each other as human beings, especially during times of grief. When we really need help, often it's hardest to ask for it. And I think that the opening of the play really shows that, is how difficult it is for someone to really step forward and say, I can't do this. Especially for those of us or, you know, people in the culture who really are charged with being in charge and knowing the answers, it's even harder to ask for help.
Meaning the firemen.
Exactly. Exactly.
What's so interesting, one of the things that I was thinking about while watching it, is that speaking and writing are such different processes. And the fireman can speak and he can say everything, but he can't write any of it down, and the writer knows exactly what to choose.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, and I think there's that element, too, where, you know, Nick, the firefighter, is kind of overwhelmed by the heroic language of all these people that everyone's getting pummeled with, about everyone's, they're a hero and they're larger than life. And so he kind of comes in feeling like he doesn't know how to encapsulate that. He knows them as, you know, as people, and that's what Joan really helps him to start talking about.
Now, this whole thing of soldier as hero or firefighter as hero, I felt and sort of feel in general that the word is just so overused.
we call baseball players and football players heroes. You hear that thrown around for everything. You know, and I think that that's part of the language, is what bothers him, bothers both of them. It's just sort of that tossed around language, and that it ends up losing its meaning. What a hero actually is lost when it's, you know, thrown around for a kick around a football team who wins in the last second of a game.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and it's also that thing of, I don't know, when people get defined as heroes, it's almost like they're different from everyone else, but I think it's, you know, the really powerful thing is these are people just like us. They're in extraordinary circumstances, and they're not these superheroes. I mean, they're people, you know, and I think that's one of the real beautiful things about this play, is you really learn about these men as just people.
You, Scott Harrison, do a mean New York firefighter accent.
Thanks to YouTube.
Really? Where on YouTube do you go to find that accent?
Well, I had a voice teacher in school who helped me with some of the just kind of the basic things. But then I wanted to find a real person. And there was a firefighter on who's got large chunks of an interview on YouTube. And he's from New York and he's a firefighter. And I liked the way that it just kind of resonated with me. So I used him as a model.
The play was written by somebody named Ann Nelson, and I guess it's pretty autobiographical. In other words, the character that you play, Karen Lee, is a lot like Ann Nelson. She herself was helping a firefighter write eulogies. Is that right?
That is correct. It's my understanding that her brother was or is also a writer, and they both were asked to help out, and then it ended up being mostly her. And so it's interesting. She had never written a play before, but she was telling Jim Simpson at an event, who runs the Flea Theater downtown New York, about her experience helping this this fire captain write eulogies. And he was like, boy, you should really turn that into a play. He was looking for something that was immediate, because their season seemed beside the point after this happened. You know, all the businesses down there were hurting, including the Flea. But they wanted to address the grief, the immediacy of what was happening. And of course, this play was written long before we knew the fallout from 9/11. So we have that knowledge. But when this play was written, it was about then. And so it's sort of a composite. I'm sure she, I don't know that the names are changed to protect them, whatever. I don't
I'm
know.
Sure they are.
And although the character of Joan is not probably totally Ann Nelson, yes, it is based on her.
It's interesting because you were doing this obviously as a 10th anniversary 9/11 commemoration, I guess you would call it. But it does bring up not the play itself, because the play is so immediate of that time, but it does bring up for the audience, when do you stop grieving? How long do you memorialize something like that? Do you memorialize it for 500 years or 10 years or what? And especially, as you said, you know, the aftermath has been so brutal. I mean, how many, maybe 200 or 300 Iraqi people killed for everybody that died on 9/11?
Right. Well, I think the thing to remember personally, I want Scott and Mona to, you can jump in any time, but for me, I think remembering, I mean, I don't think it can't help but be political because of the subject matter, but this play deals more with who's standing beside you, and that intimacy in dealing with another human being and dealing with grief. And it is hard. I mean, some of the monologues when they were written and everything, Mona and I were working on some of them. It's like knowing what we know now and everything. So we had to really address it in a different sort of way.
Well, I mean, I mean, the thing that drew me to the story, I mean, one of the things that drew me to the story was just something that came out of that time period, which was just people all over the country just being kind to one another and helping each other and people asking for help. And I think that that's something that's always exists and we can always be aware of, and I think that this play is a good reminder of, you know, how powerful kindness can be.
One of the things in it also is that, I mean, especially in a place like New York where there are so many social strata and it's so huge, there's kind of a big difference between the writer and the fireman, or you think so at first.
Right.
But then they seem kind of more alike. And I was thinking also as I was watching the rehearsal that that's kind of less of an issue in a place like Santa Fe where everybody kind of knows each other,
sure.
whatever their social stratum is.
Yeah.
What were some of the challenges for you, Mona, of directing this play?
Really keeping it unsentimental and keeping it a piece between these two people needing to get a job done. And that to me is the challenge in the piece as a director. Not to sentimentalize any of it. That there's a job to be done, and there's something each of them need from each other in order to get it done. And to not, you know, I mean, the other challenges are just, you know, the challenges you always come up against as an actor. I mean, I'm an actor primarily. This is
right.
The first thing I've directed, and so personally, the challenge is to make sure I'm seeing the entire picture.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and making sure I'm keeping that on track as well as seeing, you know, the individual actor. and giving them enough space to do their work, because they don't need me to get in their way. And so that was something I was always keeping myself in check about, was making sure I wasn't getting in their way.
There's
I hope.
There are, everyone's great. Laughing. She's
I think it helps her being an actor, because she approaches it in such a way that...
The play is different from most plays. I think the play is itself a eulogy that has four eulogies in it. And unlike most plays, it doesn't have as much of a dramatic arc. The people don't change so much from beginning to end. It's more like a presentation of a moment in time. Did you feel that way?
A little bit. I mean, I think they do grow, because they each begin to see how many tools are in the world to survive, and that you can have different tools that serve the same purpose, and everyone's tools are worth seeing and worth being used. And so I think for that, they do grow. But I also agree that it is a slice, a very specific slice of these people's life. You don't, see the dramatic event. The dramatic event has already happened.
Right.
But they do. I think they do change. I think they do grow.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. There's a lot with both of them, I think, where they initially see each other in a certain light. Mm-hmm. And over the course of the play, they discover lots of different facets of each other that they didn't initially see or recognize.
And as an audience member, you fall in love with all four firemen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good.
That's great.
Yeah, that's good. What it's about. I mean,
That's
as opposed to victims or stats.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's the title of the play is the guys. It's the four guys, in my mind, and to bring those four men into the theater with us and into the rehearsal space every night is very important.
Now, this play, The Guys, is it opens tonight, and it's this weekend and next weekend, Thursday and Friday at 7:30 in the evening, and then Saturday and Sunday at 4 in the afternoon. Thursday, September 8th, is Pay What You Can. And the whole thing is a benefit for Warehouse 21.
Exactly.
A little bit after this happened, I was working at Warehouse 21 in early 2002 on a show, and the fallout from 9/11, seeing young people and having nieces and nephews myself, and I wanted it to benefit that space, because I like the fact that they don't, teens can go there and they're not, they can just do their art and they're not censored. They express themselves without, being judged for whatever they present there, in a safe environment.
Mona Malik is the director, and Karen Lee and Scott Harrison are the two cast members of The Guys. Thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe. We'll see you tonight, and for tickets, people can call 603-1370 in the 505 area code, and Warehouse 21 right here in Santa Fe. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.